So that's tomorrow. Lots of stuff going on. I really hope you can come down at some point and take part in that. If anybody doesn't know, the toilets go through this blue tarpaulin through there, take a left down the steps into the other bit of the boat. That's where the toilets are. Now, today is a little bit different. We're running this a little bit different. It's basically a workshop. And as far as I understand, not being an expert on workshops, what Sylvia wants to do is she'll be doing a tour, but please interrupt with your questions. And we'll try and see if we can get a debate going. If we had enough room, we'd have put in a big circle and made it nice. And I'm sure, it'll be fine. So, Sylvia.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for coming today. And as Bob just said, I'd like this to be maybe a little bit more informal than, the talk I gave the other night, in the sense that, I like you to stop me, interrupt me as I'm presenting some of the ideas that I developed on the question of the body as a site for exploitation as well as resistance. And then, hopefully we'll have more discussion at the end. What I want to do, basically, is to present some of the main ideas that I developed in Caliban and the West on the question of the body. And I will explain in a minute why I chose this category to discuss, the transformation that the position of women and reproduction undergo in the transition to capitalism. But I also like to, touch upon some of the work that I plan to do in the coming months and years, and some of the issues that are more directly related to the capital plan for the body in our time, which I think is very extensive. It's part of a new phase of attempted appropriation of body powers, and certainly particularly directed towards the appropriation of the female body, and as well as the attempt to separate the production of life and the production of reproductive activities from women themselves. So I hope I managed to cover this in the time that I have. First, I came to the discussion of the body basically trying to develop a question I had, which inspired the beginning of this book, which was what happened in the transition to a capitalist society, to our creative powers, to our bodies. I was initially motivated to write Caliban and the Witch, both by my experience in the women's movement, as well as my dissatisfaction with Marx's account of primitive accumulation, which is the period in Marx, according to Marx, in which the foundation for a capitalist society are based. Marx described primitive accumulation, at least one of the conditions for primitive accumulation, as the expropriation of the peasantry, from land, from the land. But he also added quite soon that, of course, expropriation was not enough to turn these landless peasants into good workers, into good wage workers. And a lot more had to happen. In fact, many of the expropriated peasants had to be whipped on the road to the labor market. At the same time, Marx prospected a future in which the discipline of wage labor could become something natural to workers, could become the laws of capitalism, could be, in a sense, applied, could work in such a way that workers would take capitalist relation as something natural. Of course, that has never happened. Yeah, to our day, we know that the social relations that are the essence of a capitalist society have never really been appeared natural to those who have been subjected to it, and in fact have been a soil for the great resistance. But I was very much interested in finding out, you know, that part of the history of the formation of the European proletariat that Marx never covered, and to understand, you know, what happened to those workers, what happened to those workers, how did they come to accept capitalist relations as quote-unquote natural relations. And this was the beginning of an exploration in the concept of the body, as well as exploration in the concept of work and exploitation under capitalism. The focus on the body was also prompted by, you know, the theories that were being developed at the time when I began Caliban and the Witch, and primarily feminist theories and also post-structuralist theories, for example, such as those of Foucault being the primary one, that influenced this work, as well as the work and practice of the feminist movement, all of which basically were, you know, showing that the body has nothing natural. We're redefining what we mean by the body in the sense of denying that the body is a natural given, and showing instead that the body is a social construct, is a product, that is the product of a wide range of social techniques and struggles, and that therefore, when we look at the body, we always should look at something that has been historically produced, and it's also a place of contestation. It's a place, in a sense, that bears the mark of the struggle, you know, between oppressed and oppressors, subject and masters, and the workers in capital. And in fact, more and more, the body in recent literature has also begun to be seen as a kind of a text, a text that can be read precisely in terms of the marks that it bears of sedimenting the struggles on which the body has been produced. So this was the starting of my approach, and the question that I asked in the book is, well, what happened to the body in capitalism, and what makes the capitalist society, what makes capitalist power specific in its relationship to the workers' body? What is the difference between the way capitalism as a compass of social relation defines, treats, approaches the human body, and the way other society, pre-capitalist society, at least European pre-capitalist society, dealt with it. And clearly, and this is one of the main theses I present in the Caliban and the Witch, and I don't think this is that original thesis at all, is that, in fact, what distinguishes capitalism is the fact that capitalism, looks at the body fundamentally, as a sort of container for labor power. In other words, I trace the specificity of the capitalist approach to the body, right, to the specificity of the capitalist conception as to what constitutes the sources of wealth, and value, which represents a historic shift from a feudal conception, a pre-capitalist conception that basically saw wealth consisting in the availability of land, the domination of a land, in a sense, the size of land, the powers of the land, also shaped, traced the demarcation and the limits of human labor, against the capitalist conception that basically sees, you know, labor as the fundamental source of wealth, and labor also is something that it's itself capable of development, that it's a power that can actually be expanded, that can actually be developed. And I, in fact, looked at the policy that in the 16th century, or policies that in the 16th century and 17th century, you know, begin to be put into place at all kinds of different levels, you know, towards the body as an expression of this new interest, you know, for labor. And therefore, an interest in understanding, better understanding the powers of the body, and understanding which among these powers should be developed, which should be eliminated or repressed, right? With the guideline being the attempt, in a sense, to transform human energies and transform human powers into work energy, into work power, into the power to work, into the capacity to work. And I interpret much of the social practice and social theory, as well as philosophical and scientific theory, of the period of the transition, the 16th and 17th century, very much from this point of view. And you know, perhaps many of these questions, many of these developments are developments I'm sure you're, you know, familiar with. But what I do in the chapter that I devote to the body, you know, I look, for example, at you know, the way in which, you know, the elite of Europe in this period, you know, waged a battle to transform, to erase, you know, what had been a magical conception of the body, you know, which you know, prevailed, you know, through the Renaissance, you know, into the 16th and 17th century. You know, a conception that basically, you know, saw the body as you know, as a basically as a microcosm, as a reality very much connected to the surrounding, you know, universe. The microcosm as you know, part of a much broader natural world that continuously interacted with it and continuously influenced it, right? For example, the idea, you know, the prevailing idea of the what I call the magical conception of the body was the idea that, that you, I'm sure you're familiar with from astrology, the revival of astrology in the at the in the 60s, for example, the idea that the movement of the stars, right, had an influence on our health and our influence on our emotion. In other words, it was a conception in which very, very different. They saw the body as a very broad reality, a reality that was on a continuum, you know, with the surrounding environment and with all kinds of powers that in fact could be tapped into, which is one of the ideas at the foundation of magic. Well, certainly this kind of body, this conception of the body, was not compatible, right, with a kind of discipline, work discipline, that capitalism was in the process of instituting already with the development of manufacture in the 16th and 17th century, and a work discipline that increasingly basically relied on the determination of very regular forms of behavior, and so that many of the beliefs that were connected with the magical idea of the body, for example, the idea that we could be in two places at the same time, and so forth, were clearly incompatible, you know, with a type of work discipline where our work had to be defined in a very regular way, uniform way, to be measured by labor time, and so that in fact the attack of magic, it's an attack also on a particular type of conception of body powers. In fact, what I see happening to the body in the transition to capitalism is what I see happening to the working class as a whole, that is a process of impoverishment. Usually we see the rise of capitalism is expanding, you know, the powers that we have in expanding wealth, but actually I profoundly believe that capitalism has been fundamentally a production of scarcity. And if in fact new powers have been gained, these have been a product of struggle, not a product of the capitalist organization of work. So that in fact one trend that begins to take hold and in the transformation that occurred to the body in the transition to capitalism is this impoverishment, you know, in the same way as workers were impoverished because they lost their land with the price revolution, their wages and money collapsed, their wages were decimated. And the same way also the conception of the powers of the individual was subjected to a very radical redefinition, that in a sense they limited those powers to very specific work powers. And it's very interesting to see how this process begin to occur at different levels. For example, at the medical level, I'm going to go very quickly here because you can read the details in the book, but certainly medicine played already in the 16th century an important role into this process of impoverishment, and also, you know, what becomes the dominant trend, the process of mechanization of the body, where the body becomes precisely because of the need to control the labor process, the body is conceptualized more and more as a machine, as a work machine, and an important impulse to this development, you know, comes from the medical profession, in particular from the development of anatomy, you know, in the 16th century. That basically, you know, anatomy is an important break, if you want, the work of the most important anatomist of this period, particularly Vesalius, right? It's the final poo-poo, the final break with the magical body, because, you know, anatomy basically shows the body as a machine, right? It's the difference in a body that has nothing sacred any longer. It's a collection of pieces, subjugated, opened up, deprived of any secret, open to the medical gaze, and revealed in all its secret, and also, you know, with the development of anatomy, you really begin have a objectification of the body that is fundamental to his conception as a work machine. And of course, the mechanization of the body also, most importantly, took place through social practice, by the development of a penal system and of a work process that very much resembled the process of punishment. You know, like at the very same time that you have the takeoff on a mass scale of the witch hunt in the latest part of the 16th century, you know, in England and in Holland, you have the development of the first workhouses, And the workhouses were really a powerful mixture of prison and factories. In fact, they were the model for both. As you probably know, that the people who refused to accept, you know, work, or refused the kind of wages, fixed wages, that were imposed upon them, and preferred to take the load, preferred to become vagabond, preferred to become quote criminals and outlaws. They were rounded up and put into these workhouses. They were not so important so much because of what they produced. The workhouses really were not important as places of production. They were really important as places of production of disciplined bodies, of disciplined workers. In other words, when you look at what was the kind of activities that were organized in the workhouses, you see very clearly that the most fundamental goal of these places was to train and educate people to work. And that in fact, the way the tasks were chosen, they were chosen in such a way that they were intended to really break the resistance, right? To break the resistance to work, they break the resistance to you know, a kind of discipline that was seen as clearly antagonistic to any, you know, instinctual need, instinctual desire, and in fact, you know, the workhouse, as I said before, begins to develop and perform the kind of function that later the prisons do, you know, to our own day, and particularly the function of molding people into the development of a work discipline.
Is the implication that prior to capitalism, prior to rationality, all these other forces, that there was people were freer, or you know, it wasn't that in the period before that, the control was operated by the church, by superstition, by fear. The implication seems to be that there was a kind of you're not saying utopia, but a kind of better sort of life before that. And well, my limited knowledge of history suggests that that was the case.
No, yeah, I think what I'm talking about, I'm not trying to set up a contrast between a golden age preceding capitalist society. In fact, I see the development of capitalism as really a response, you know, to the struggles of the Middle Age, of the peasantry and workforce of the Middle Age, of the medieval period, against feudal power. So there was an intense struggle, clearly through the Middle Age, there was exploitation. I think what I'm talking about, and of course in this situation we have little time, you end up making setting up schemes. We're talking about what is the difference. There are different regimes of exploitation, different forms of exploitation, which have their own logic, right? Their own aims, and what I'm basically interested in is to see what is specific to capitalism, what happened to the body. I mentioned the magical body because, yes, indeed, through the Middle Ages you do have, and into the Renaissance, particularly because of the Renaissance, we can see some historical reasons for it, but you have a concept of the body as having all kinds of fantastic powers. Not many of these powers we obviously don't believe in it today, right? But there's certainly a very drastic change of regime, a very drastic change of conception as to, you know, what, for example, to give an idea, and I'm talking now at the level of the elites, you know, throughout the 14th, 15th, and perhaps into the 16th century, right? The concept of the imagination, the concept of powers they thought individual had, right? For example, the imagination was seen as something very creative, that not only creative of idea, but almost productive of realities. The belief also in the process of vision, right? The way we see, we look at things. Mm-hmm. So you have a conception that believed in an interaction between viewer and viewed. So that, for example, you know, what you viewed left an imprint, literally a physical bodily imprint, you know, in the person, right? So in the case of women, it meant that when you were pregnant, and some of these ideas have survived almost into the present, that when you're pregnant, if you see things that horrify you, those sights will have an impact on the fetus, right? For example, if you have desires that you cannot fulfill, or if you see a sight that will be disturbing, that will have repercussion, because there was an idea that when you see something, that the world around you was not a world detached from you, but there was a continuity of powers between the visible, between the seen and the seer, and that in other words, that the person was involved. I'm not trying to say that this was, if you want, a better conception. I'm simply trying to say that this comes to an end, right? The world of the anatomist, in a sense, not only cuts up the body in separate pieces and begins to conceptualize it as a machine, but also begins to look at the body of the person as a separate reality, as isolated, right, from the environment, from the connection with the natural world, as well as the connection with the surrounding social world. By what used to be called the influences, right? And I don't want to put a positive value sign, but I am recording that the notion of the body in a sea of influences and reaction and encounter reaction within the natural environment begins to be curtailed, right? Begins to be undermined. I think that the history. One of the I spoke about the impoverishment of the body, in the sense that it's seen as having less power. Perhaps the power that people imagine were imaginary, were fantastic, were unfounded. But certainly there's a different conception that reduces the idea of what bodily powers are, and in a sense centralizes those bodily power towards the power that are useful and important into the work process. And I'm not trying to realize, but I'm trying to show that there's an important difference. And I think the one trend in the development of the body in the history of capitalism has also been this process of isolation, right? That in a sense individualizes. By individualizes the person, individualizes the social relation, and also individualizes the body. It begins to separate it from the environment, and also break down a certain type of bodily solidarity that I think was certainly more prominent in the pre-capitalist world than solidarity, for example, with animals. I don't know if it is it's setting up a sort of utopia to say that, for example, throughout until the 16th century, you have, we were speaking about it the other night, you have a continuity in the relationship and in the conception between the animal world and the human world. There is basically a continuity in the way animals are conceived and humans are conceived, to the sense that the animals were somewhat humanized, and human beings were seen as taking over. For example, you have a relationship, which I think is present in many cultures. in many cultures, that pre-capitalist, non-capitalist cultures, that human beings and animals are somewhat interchangeable. Human beings are taken to take over animal power. Sometimes they transform themselves into animals when they want to express or embody certain powers. And by the same token, you have animals who at times are seen as thinking animals. In the Middle Age, medieval bestiaries, for instance, you had the talking dogs. Right? You had dogs who may play the advisors to humans. I mentioned that until even the mid-16th century, you had animal trials in Europe because it was assumed that animals were agent, responsible agents. So again, I don't want to, it's not a question of, falling into utopia, but certainly this has been an historic trend, the separation between the need to demarcate much more precisely what is human and what is non-human, what is human and what is animal, right, is something that begins to become very evident in the period that I'm referring to. And also the devaluation of what we call animality, or the animal world, by that animals begin to be seen as themselves, on a far lower level with respect to human beings than it had been the case in rural pre-capitalist societies of Europe. So that there is a degradation of the animal that begins to take place. Right? So what I'm saying is that what I've been trying to show is that throughout one of the developments that the main trend that we have to include in the process that goes under the name of the formation of the working class, of the modern working class, right, is very much this process of redefinition of bodily powers. It's a process of mechanization of the body, deconceptualization of the body on the model of the machine, so that the body is seen as a work machine, and in a sense also increasing isolation of the body, increasing isolation, if you want, in the sense of a new separation from the natural world, the animal world, and also the human world, the sort of embodied, if you want, solidarity that was more common of societies that had communal relationship, that where work activity was on a communal basis. In fact, there have been studies that have been made, even to this day, right, those studies that show in which country, how much space people need around themselves and, to feel comfortable when they talk. This I'm talking about recent studies, right? I know they are very popular in the United States. So they would know, for example, at what stage an African person feels uncomfortable, in terms of distance from the other, and compare, for example, to the United States or to Europe. And showing, for example, that increasingly, the more you go towards countries that are industrialized, that are fully capitalized, etc., etc., right, people tend to need much more space around them. They need to have a bigger distance between them and those they are talking to, and that feel, in fact, very uncomfortable when they are too close to the body of others. They feel threatened by that closeness, precisely indicating that exemplifying the process of separation that I've been referring to. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could I'd like to know what you think about gender in all of
yeah.
this, and the relationships between men and women. You're talking about the body as if it's the same for everyone.
Right. In fact, I was just going to counter okay. it. Yeah, I was just going to counter it. Like now, in fact, that's exactly what I was going to say. That, however, if the trend, these trends towards the mechanization of the body are, in fact, you know, far more pronounced in the case of women. And what I began to, you know, one of the themes in my work was precisely to, one of the reasons for my work was also in response to the fact that the mechanization of the body, the discipline of the body, has to a great extent, certainly prior to the women's movement, obviously studied in relation to the formation of the proletarian body, the male proletarian body. It has never been seen, you know, in relation, you know, to women. And it has not been seen that, in fact, that the same process of mechanization has taken place with regard to the female body, and that, in fact, it has, to some extent, carried over even to a more extreme a conclusion. And in fact, one of the you know, theses that has shaped, you know, my work has been that we cannot really speak of a history of the body. That in fact, if it is the case that what has shaped the attitude of you know, the capitalist class towards is further shape the policies of the capitalist class towards the body as being, you know, the need to train a workforce, a productive and docile workforce, and to forward the productivity of labor, then, you know, we have to also see that even the organization, the division of labor on the sexual, racial, and international basis, each of these levels in the organization of work has produced also different concepts of the body. So that we should have, for example, not only a history of the white male wage worker's body, but a history of the female body, a history of the African slaves, male and female, see this, them to differentiate it, a history of the colonized body, and in fact, these histories now have been written. Today I can only touch on some general point, but I, you know, over the last 10 years, there's been a very, very important production of books. They look, for example, what happened to the body of Native American, you know, as they were being, as their communities were destroyed, as they were being marched to death, or to being closed into reservation, or that, of course, the African slave's body, and one of the latest work that I've seen has been a very, very powerful analysis of the transformation and the body politics, you know, of that has, I mean, basically entrepreneur of the gold mines in South Africa, you know, towards their African workforce, you know, showing that before they would, in the 40s and 50s, before they would let African workers to go and dig gold, they would subject them to a whole set of body rituals that basically, you know, prepare them to the kind of you know, intensity of and hardship that they would encounter with the heat, and they would encounter with, of course, the murderous environment, I mean, of the gold mines. And, you know, ritual, for example, has what would be called tests to heat, to see, for example, if they would be able to resist the heat. But there were actual rituals in humiliation and subjugation. They would have these workers to, you know, strip naked and perform all kinds of movements that basically introduced them to the idea that, you know, anything can be done to you, that you should be ready to accept, you know, all kinds of impositions once you enter into this activity, you know, say basically rituals that break your spirit. And this is what, you know, I'm talking about when I'm talking about the transition to capitalism. It's not necessarily that the medieval worker was a free worker, but that different regimes of power have different techniques. I mean, this is one of the themes also for Foucault's work. Different regimes of power have different techniques to, you know, impose a certain type of discipline, social and work discipline. Now, I spoke about the mechanization of the women's body, and this is in fact is a very important thing which I want to elaborate on, because I feel like it's really essential. In time, as a product transformation of you know, the work process, and in a sense, the molding, you know, of a more docile workforce, and also the fact that the development of workers' struggle in Europe, throughout Europe, you begin to have a development of contractual relationship. Until the 17th century, wage worker, the male wage worker, was pretty much in the condition of an indentured servant. You really didn't have the so-called free labor market in Europe until the 18th century. Until through the 17th century, there was practically very little freedom the wage workers had, even though they had a wage. Eventually, with the development, you know, with worker struggles and game changes that I cannot go through it now, you know, you have a relationship in which the wage relation begins to function much more as a contract. And at that point, it's also the point in which you begin to see a different relation between the worker and their body, in which, in a sense, there is an attempt to, you know, there is a new kind of discipline that comes into place, where you know, the worker is seen as the male worker, I would say, we're seen as having a subjectivity, as having a self, and in the conception of the body that begins to percolate among the ruling elite, a conception that existed first for the ruling class, but now is extended also to workers, is that the body is a little capital that we have. We are the owners of this capital, and we have to learn to manage it. In other words, with the development of a more contractual relationship among male wage worker, you also have a change in which the worker is not seen as a pure animal to be whipped, to be controlled with the whip, but begins to be seen as someone, an individual, who is capable of asserting self-management, right? Is capable, and you begin to have the certain type of worker that becomes visible, certainly in the 19th century. And now this worker is trained in all kinds of ways to social policy as well as, you know, religious policy, to learn to manage his body, his power, and, you know, like a little capitalist does, right? And to develop a process of self-discipline. Well, this never took place in the case of women. Like, women were never, because of the position the women begin to occupy in the division of labor that comes into place with the development of capitalism, where increasingly women are confined to a type of work that is completely naturalized. So even if they have a little wage work on the side, you know, earning a little bit as maid, nurses and so on, increasingly the work of women is seen as reproductive labor, and that reproductive labor is seen as a natural activity, it's not seen as an economic activity, it's seen basically as a natural thing. In consequence, you find that women are seen more and more as bodies. And in fact, more and more women are seen as reproductive machines, right? And you find this image of the woman machine, of the womb, the breeder. You find it in many different registers, not only in religion. For example, I mentioned the other night, you know, even one of the advocates of this view of women as the breeders was certainly Luther, who continuously in his work speaks of women as wombs, right? But you also find it at many other levels. For example, certainly the medical profession. I think the 16th and the 17th century is the period in which the historic role of the medical profession as, in a sense, the one of the main controllers of women's work and women's body, like, begins to take place. And if you look at the anatomic treatises and medical treatises of this period, from the 16th century on, you see there's a really great interest, if not obsession, with the uterus. Right? And in fact, increasingly, the uterus and the female body become the kind of emblematic object of anatomy. You know, the object to be anatomized par excellence. Why? Because they show that anatomy, medicine can make visible what is invisible, right? Can actually dominate nature, can actually basically show the power of medicine to in a sense, grasp the secrets of women, right? Which had been a great preoccupation of the medical profession, at least in its initial stage, right? There is a kind of obsession that you find in medical books about the fact that, you know, women have these secrets, you know, in the double sense that women have the, quote, secret knowledge. In other words, they control the knowledge of their reproductive functions. Pretty much through the Middle Ages, it was women that, were involved in the process of birthing and their activities surrounding reproductive, birthing and reproduction. So this one of the, in fact, of the theme of the medical profession in its development is to take over this knowledge, in a sense, to posit themselves, posit medical knowledge as the true knowledge, you know, against the superstitious and false knowledge of women, and so to take over the secret, to reveal the secret, and also to open up the female body, right? The secretive character of the female body, because the reproductive organs are hidden within it. And so anatomy, in a sense, scores built in a way their prestige on the capacity to open up the female body. Mm. And I would say again, I do not want to put, you don't have to put a value judgment on this development. Simply to say that this is now, is recordable, these are developments are quite recordable. They are empirically demonstrable just by looking at some of the theories and concern that you find in among medical practitioners and anatomists. I inserted in my section on the body the picture that Vesalius, the most important anatomist in Europe in the 16th century, and he wrote a volume called The Factory of the Human Body. And interesting enough, he chose as the title page of that book the body of a dissected woman. Uterus, in fact, sexual organs are dissected. In fact, she's presented as lying down, surrounded by literally a male crowd that is looking at her. And so her body is, it's really a very powerful image, I would say, of you know, science as domination of the female body, and you know, the female body is subjugated, right? And placed under the gaze of the doctor, which appears all powerful in this relationship. You know, there is a literature that many feminists have written on this topic about the fact that, you know, starting at least from the Renaissance period on, you know, the medical profession has been engaged in this kind of not only of attempt to dominate the female body, but also appropriate, take over into its hand the power of life, right? First by controlling the female body, and then more recently in our own times by attempting to reproduce life independently of women. Of course, that is not yet achieved, right? But many of the new technologies, reproductive technologies, are certainly, you know, attempting to move in that direction. Right? Attempt to realize the old chemical dream, you know, of the scientists, you know, capable of freeing the human activities from the domination of nature, and create life on a purely manufactured basis, by manufacturing life, right, which has been a theme that has continued. I want to touch on a few more points, and then I want to open up the discussion, simply to say that, you know, what I've been interested in, and what I'm interested now in developing is to look at what is the history of the mechanization of the female body, and what has been the different developments, the different periods of that mechanization, and to connect those periods and connect those developments, you know, with transformation into the work process. In other words, one of the theories that principle that I'm following is that, you know, as the production process, the organization of work, the organization of production changes, as impact of struggles, as impact of the technological transformation and so forth, and as the relationship between production and reproduction changes, right? So also, you know, the conception of the body, you know, what the body should do and body powers that are transformed. Right, and again, these processes should never be seen as unilateral. They're processes that always result from resistance as well. But so this is what I've been trying to develop, and I can see a periodization whereby certainly the 16th and 17th century are fundamental for the redefinition, reconstruction of the female body. And what I'd say also, the demonization of certain aspects of the female personality, for example, the demonization of female sexuality, that clearly has to be, you know, increasingly was banned in all those situations in which those non-procreative, non-productive. There is an attempt, in a way, to desexualize women, in a sense, to to the extent that sexuality is seen as a danger, as subversive of work discipline, and is seen also as subversive, right, of the role of women as mothers, as producers of children, as reproducers, right? But of course, sexuality could never be exercised. I mean, there should be a lot of talk about, what the treatment of the witches did in terms of redefining the female body. Right? What hundreds of thousands of women burned or hanged, you know, what that process did, for example, to enclose the female body. Not only enclose the land, but enclose the female body in terms of terrorizing women from away from certain activities. For example, contraception, for example, abortion, etc., etc. Or terrorizing women from a certain type of exercise of their sexuality. And there is a whole chapter there which I think has to even be even more explored as the witch hunt and the remolding, redefinition, reconstruction of the female body. So that, you know, I mentioned the other night, at the beginning you see that the witch is taken as a symbol of femininity and is presented, femininity through the witch, is presented as aggressive, lusty, instinctually uncontrollable. And at the end of the witch hunt, you have a redefinition of femininity, which is the image of a subjugated woman. The woman is pale, passive, obedient, silent, etc., etc. So I see certainly the witch hunt is part of the large process of redefinition of femininity, redefinition of the female body. But of course, not all could be exorcised. And in fact, what I see as happening in the following two centuries is that the function of women as reproducers, you know, reproducers of the workforce, which is the way they are increasingly defined, you know, begins to undergo a further division, a further specialization by and producing two different types of bodies. And of course, on one side, you know, the prostitute, now prostitution, recuperating sexuality, but in a form that is underground, criminalized, where sexuality is seen as something as polluting, as dangerous, and again, something that needs to be controlled by the state, and is seen as potentially antisocial, and therefore used, but also abused. And on the other side, the woman has purely maternity, mother role, and these are the two, it's the bifurcation that the role of women begins to undergo, with the middle-class woman filling the role of the pure mother, completely desexualized. I've been working on reconstructing some of the struggle that put in crisis this model. I think that this crisis of the angel of the fireplace and the, you know, the woman, horrible woman in the street, this is a division of labor that certainly came into crisis at the turn of the 20th century, and clearly came into crisis on the basis of all kinds of women's struggles, and also because of that particular contradiction, which is, I believe, at the center of the capitalist reproductive politics, I believe, into today. By struggle of women, I mention the struggle of, the hidden struggle of women in the through the 19th century, which often has been seen as invisible, has been invisible, but I think many feminists have rediscovered the fact that, you know, women people in the middle class have used disease, right? Have used disease as a form of power, as a form of refusal, right? As a form of refusal of a sexuality that was imposed on them purely in view of their maternal role, and in view of relationship with men, they were very suffocating and oppressive. And so, for example, if you look at the literature, certainly in the literature in the United States, you find that, you know, women use the kind of fragility and the medicalization of their bodies and medicalization of their function, for example, the medicalization of reproductive function, that the doctors had used to, in a sense, control them, and they actually turned them around and played on those, on their weakness as an element of refusal. What I refer to is the kind of epidemics of female illnesses that has been recorded by, you know, in the feminist social literature of looking at the 19th century middle class women, Victorian women, you know, the fainting, the frequency of illnesses and diseases that is seen as, in fact, not a biological product, but in fact as a form of struggle, because people use whatever is available to them to struggle against the form of oppression that are imposed on them. And at the same time, you know, the crisis was, particularly England, was a very good example. By the 19th century, the ruling class in England was very much concerned that low level of reproduction and the fact that the working class woman was so, you know, very much in a sense that the level of reproduction was so low among the working class, and the fact that in the working class you could actually clearly tell the difference between the mother and the whore, that this was posing a crisis, you know, a social crisis, in that, you know, you had all kinds of workers that were not properly produced. You had an army of workers, of soldiers, they were too weak for the wars that the British Empire wanted to fight. And so you begin to have a whole rethinking about the policies towards women's work and towards also the female body, and a policy in which, going very fast, I see the development of psychology, psychoanalysis as having played an important role in mapping up some of the theories that you know, redefined, you know, the female role. Which, you know, Freud is a good example here. You know, he was very much concerned with the crisis of the family, the crisis of reproduction in all fronts. And basically, he was one of those who argued first for a reintegration of sexuality into the feminine identity and into, you know, redefining the female body as a sexualized body. Okay, I think I want to stop here only to say that the women's movement, I see the women's movement as precisely the movement that women have launched to refuse those separation and refuse that naturalization of women's activity and refuse that mechanization of their body. And not accidentally, one of the slogans of the women's movement was, "Let's retake, you know, our bodies." And I see also much of the development that had taken place in medicine, and social practice, particularly the reorganization of the division of labor in following the globalization process. The new kind of international division of labor is coming to place as really a response to this, you know, refusal. And you know, I like to hear from you, because the you know, what is your experience in this process? But I just want to say that you know, what we are witnessing now, it's with genetic engineering, is certainly the whole over the last 20 years, and the weight of science has been brought to bear again on the female body and you know, the reproduction of life, and to try to actually control, you know, reproduction in a way that increasingly makes it, you know, independent of women. And in fact, to relaunch not only a new concept of femininity, deceased women as very passive again, deceased the female body as almost irrelevant to the production of life, as something very passive. The debate around surrogacy, for example, as stressed continuously this passivity of the female body, you know, that is seen almost like a flower pot, you know, to contain, you know, the seed, which the doctor, who is the true life giver, you know, is the doctor that it's the promoter of life, the active agent. Something that you also see in the way birthing, you know, is presently organized in the hospital, you know, where the woman is used to total passivity, hooked up to 15 machines, she's almost out of it, she's giving life, but you never know it. And in fact, the one again who is the life giver is seen as the doctor. You know, the doctor is the one. And of course, it's very good that the doctors are there to deal with emergency. In the 16th century, many women died of postpartum infection. But at the same time, there's been a movement of revolt against that among women. In fact, the home birth movement that has tried, you know, to regain control. I mean, basically, you know, as a part of the feminist movement, feminist attempt to reappropriate the body, the home birth movement has been very, very, very strong. Women have wanted to reclaim their agency, you know, in the process of the production of life. And, you know, I see, not only I myself, but I think many of us see that the development of biology in the 70s, 80s, and on has been a constant encroachment and an attempt to redefine women, the women's body, but also the body as a whole. Right, to redefine the body as a whole, as something that is, you know, not whole, you know, a conglomerate of genes, right, selfish genes, each with his own program, struggling, using actually the person as a vehicle, right, so not only the woman is a passive and a flower pot, but I mean the body of the person as a whole is now dismembered, is integrated into these little competing genes, each with their own plan, and you know, where in fact then the doctor, who is more and more presented, and the scientist as the one who, knowing the DNA, right, who knows the secret of life and is the position to reproduce it. Okay, thank you, and I'd like to hear your questions, comments, and criticism.
Can I start the comment then? What you were saying comes across to me that what you're describing is a big shift and changes. Mm-hmm. It appears to me to be very deliberate. other words, the view I get, you have sort of a view that there's the ruling class there, and a very clear idea about what they're seeking to achieve. So those changes you were talking about from the 19th century, views was coming across to me, that you were describing first, it appeared to be very deliberate, very much, the ruling class had a very clear idea about what they were seeking to achieve. I suppose what I'm saying is it doesn't come across like that to me. I prefer to see a process where there's numerous institutions doing numerous different things, and then over a period of time it sort of congeals together as a type of strategy you're describing. But at the time it wasn't something which was particularly deliberate. There was, in medicine there were people trying to achieve certain things. In terms of social policy, there were other people trying to achieve other things. In terms of popular culture, or other things happening. So over a period of time, it then comes to be the type of process you're describing.
I think there's always a danger when you present the ruling class as all-knowing, for all the tendency to institute panopticons everywhere, but to present them as all-knowing and all masterful. But at the same time, there's also a danger in underestimating to what extent there is conscious planning and conscious thinking and confrontation with social crisis. I think if I look at different periods, take for example the period between the turn of the century and the first two decades of the 20th century, when for example in say in the United States, but also in Britain, you really had a powerful transformation in the working class community and the working class family, right? And that transformation was not accidental. There was from the last part of the 19th century, there is a crisis that is talked about, right? There is a crisis that is talked about in terms of a recognition also of the role of women into shaping, right, the workforce, into shaping discipline, and the need of inculcating in work a certain types of attitude, which life in the family has to do. For example, to give just an example, in the United States, this is the period, and it's the period of Taylorism, right? Taylorism is a classical example of the human body reduced to, seen as a machine, where you have all the time motion study, where nothing is allowed in the work process that is not functional to it. Functional to labor. Well, this is also the same period, right, in which you have the institution of what we call today social workers that begin to go into the families of, working class communities, and they begin to control and see how they're eating, right, what kind of food they get, if the food they get is sufficiently nutritious to sustain, for example, certain rhythms of work, right? This is also the period in which you have a shift from light industry to heavy industry. Certainly this was the case in England, right? You go from textile to railroad and coal and so forth and steel. So you need a different type of working class, and you begin to have a much more capillary control of the process of reproduction, of the utilization of sexuality, right, so that and it's a control where it at the same time reshapes the body and reshapes the community. For example, the reintegration of sexuality into the working class family life, particularly into the life of the woman, to reconceive of the woman as having a legitimate claim to sexual life. Certainly in the States it's connected, with the attack on the saloons, right, with the attempt to discipline male workers so that, they begin to redefine their life more as home-based rather than community-based, or, based in communities that and places that was seen as subversive, as places also of politicization, of places of collective encounters, right? So that, you know, the workers have to be brought home, right? And so you have certainly not one trend pushing in one direction. I see that the integration of sexuality is coming in part out of the need of the disciplinary work, and also in part out of the fact that, you know, as Freud said, around the turn of the century, you begin to have an increase in the number of divorces. The family certainly was in crisis. I mean, like, we can go into detail if you're fine, but the increase in divorces, the resistance clearly of women through, you know, neurosis. I mean, I think that now feminists have begun to see the famous neurotic patient of Freud as, in fact, expression of a rebellion, right? And Freud says, you know, we have a crisis. The anesthetic woman, this woman who has no pleasure, you know, conceives without pleasure and procreates without pleasure, is a woman that will resist more and more maternity. Right? So in a sense, I would argue that the redefinition of the female body as one who is entitled to a certain sexual life is also instrumental, yeah, to resettle, re-sedentarize the male worker, and also to realign the woman towards the reproduction, towards maternity, which was, you know, an excess of repression, if you want, you know, placed into crisis. And I think those type of consideration, you find them. If you read Freud, I think he's very open about it. For example, but not only him. Mm. Any other questions?
Yeah, I just wanted to say something about, I mean, I think it's a good question. Yeah, how much is it a conspiracy? How much, yeah, how much agency did these people have in, you know, moulding sort of labour and stuff like that? I mean, really, I think it's important. If you just look at, like, say something like plantation slavery, which is a bit popular this year, but if you look at that, you can see, I mean, what I've read this year, that, you know, prior to your use of West African slaves, you've got all these people putting these plantations together. They're trying to develop a sugar industry, and they're using initially, like, indentured labourers from Britain, and they're using the local native population. And they write very extensively about, you know, right down to, you know, a very racial level as well, but about the Irish, the vagrants from Somerset, you know, the native Indians, and how they fail, or, you know, whether they can work in hot temperatures or cold temperatures. They start to look into the real detail of labour to be able to extract, and especially if you've got a limited workforce, which they did at the start. They've got to use these labourers as most effectively as they can. So they're doing this kind of work. And then when you get West African slavery, the detail of their analysis of their labourers is incredible. I mean, they say, oh, this lot are from, you know, some part of West Africa, we stick them in the swamps, you know, because they can deal with the malaria. You know, so there's a real examination of what they can get out of the body itself. How can they really develop the most production? How much can they feed them? Because obviously they're a commodity, these people, so they've got to feed them. They don't want to kill them. So they, you know, how much can they work them to death? You know, how hard can they work them? You know, if they die, can they replace them? What's the sums to do? You know, what are the calculations? They're doing these calculations, you know, at that time. So the whole process of producing these mass bodies of labour is a real process of management and statistics and analysis and. Really, so they were at it early, and this is in the 17th and then into the 18th. It's going on, so it's not a conspiracy, it's just how do we develop the maximum productive potential out of these people, and that's the process, I think.
Yeah, along the lines of this calculation, for example, by the 17th century, they were calculating in Holland, they were calculating how much was the worth of a slave. In Spain, say, or in the, you know, the slave trade, and they were calculating what is the worth of a slave, and on that basis begin to realize that, you know, instead of killing people when they commit a crime, we use them. For example, we put them on the galleys, or we make them work, etc., etc. You know, we have an advantage. We don't have. So you have a penal code that is redefined, and it becomes less violent, not necessarily because it's more humanitarian, right? Because it begins to look at the body in a different way, right? The body, it's useful. So you can get these people, when you hang them, you lose them. But instead, you can make them work. And these are calculations that were made on the basis, there is a book by two sociologists, Melassi and Pavarini, which is it's a great book on the organization of workhouses, but also the type of thinking that begins to come in, very utilitarian, that redefines also the penal system.
Yeah, just very quickly on two things. A workhouse, for example, comes from Jamaica. So these ideas, they're using some ideas about discipline of labour and taking them out to the Caribbean, from Ireland, in fact, the plantations in Ireland. But then they're also bringing ideas back. So they've done all these experiments in productivity, and they're going, okay, you know, we can apply this in Britain. So they're bringing it back, and the workhouse is, technically comes from Jamaica, the idea of it. But and the second thing is that those calculations that are going on, you know, how they, you know, the detail of them is really worth looking into that, because I think, you know, I was amazed at the detail. So they're really breaking it down into different groups and racial groups, and you know, they're deciding on this. When we say talk about the discipline of labour, they're not going, it's not very nice to work in a swamp, you know. That's not what they're thinking about. They're not thinking in terms of how you as a human being will relate to the work. They're just seeing how much they can get out of you and how much they can discipline that labour. That's really important, because there is the subjective side of it about whether that work, you know, destroys you within 3 years or 5 years is what they're interested in. But the actual nature of it is not important. You know, that's not a problem for them.
Okay, any experience you have with the mechanization of the body, male or female, and insight into what are the common trends and resistances, so that we can collectivize this process of knowledge production? I'm sure you know a lot from your life, your friends, your workplace, yes.
I think a lot of
You know, I'm having a hard time hearing because of this thing here. Maybe, why don't you come closer?
No? I think a lot of people can't stress themselves so much now. It's like everything is possible. Like in our sentence,
nothing. I really hate this, but I cannot hear you.
Just saying, everything costs money. Like, for you to express yourself, you do something. There's nothing you can do for free unless.
Definitely, yeah. This is part of all, the impoverishment, right? That you now have the gate of the market, everything. So your relationship to space, your relationship to communication, your relationship to imagination is forced into these channels are conditional to work and money making. But there's also a tremendous struggle taking place against that, and I think that in this way, the domination of the female, of the body, male or female, in this moment, I think is still very much divisive. I don't see that they. I see it as a challenge, but not as something that achieved. Anybody wants to? Yeah?
Well,
but then I'm really having a difficult time hearing. Is it possible to turn it off? Since we are not
going to go off in a minute.
Oh, okay.
How can we value ourselves in the marketplace? What do things like the minimum working wage mean? What do they reflect?
Can you elaborate on that
a bit? I was thinking recently, I was doing some labouring, so I wasn't producing a product myself. And I was thinking about the wage I got paid for that one day's work, and if there was, if I could conceive that wage as a profit, if there was a margin above which I'd be being paid more than what I was worth for that day's work, and that made me think about profit in terms of our labour, or Am I making sense?
I'm not sure. I think it's extremely difficult. I mean, it's not, I'm not saying impossible, but it's difficult to know what is the value of your labor, you know, given the complexity of social relations today. I don't believe myself, as some do, that the theory of value no longer holds, that there is no longer value creation, that that labor, physical or not, living labor, physical or not, it's, which I think is all physical, by the way. I'm a bit skeptical about the notion of immaterial labor, because all labor, after all, costs you in terms of, if you do it of actual work, my God, you know it's physical labor. So it's difficult to see, it seems to me that the process of relating to your wage, I mean, to whatever money you make, and I mean, you cannot think of that in terms of the profit that you are creating. I mean, it's always a collective process, it's a social process, so that it's difficult to see, evaluate what is that you are producing. But I'm sure if you look at the trend in terms of work is a part of, you can get a pretty good sense of what role does it play in the organization of work today, in the organization of accumulation today. I'm not sure about what is the... So yeah, your question is whether you are contributing to the production of profit, or whether you are getting, what kind of return you're getting from your work. What was the question in your mind? What is the... And what was the potential struggle?
Different things. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. If we think of the way society, with the introduction of the minimum working wage, that concept,
right.
What have you got any ideas about that, or
what is the role of the minimum wage?
Yeah.
What is the role of the minimum wage in society? I think the minimum wage, to a great extent, was a product of a struggle. I think if it was possible, they would not have any minimum wage. I know, for example, in the United States, there are parts of the government and the entrepreneurial class, they're very much against any idea of the minimum wage. And even raise it to 5 cents, you need rivers of blood, pretty much. I mean, people have to make struggles of years and years to get 25 cents of the minimum wage. So I don't think that those kind of guarantees, the minimum wage, which the union fought for fundamentally, they are the ones who are always in the forefront of trying to get a minimum, right? To get some guarantee that these are necessarily wanted or useful. In fact, the mantra in the States, repeated over and over and over, has been that way, the minimum wage is detrimental for the workers. Because, look, if there was no minimum wage, many more could be employed. In fact, if they were all slaves and didn't ask for anything but a pot of porridge, they could be full employment. Right? This is pretty much been the ideology of the right in the States. You know, ask less. If you ask for less, you get more jobs. Right? So that's the role, I think, the minimum wage. I mean, people have fought to at least have some in the same way as pension, if they could do away with pension. I have to say something, though. Let me now backtrack a little bit by what I said. Because it is true at the same time, right, that at least starting in the second part of the 19th century, right? Starting in the second part, you begin to have a different wage policy you know, a man in capital. Until pretty much the 1830s, zero wages, low wages, and, you know, the horses and the bayonets, when you ask for more, were the standard religion, right? And in fact, unions not allowed, etc., etc. There is a change, there is a policy change in the second part of the 19th century. It's certainly a policy change. It's not overnight, it's a change, in fact, that really, in its full development, takes a few decades. But it's part of, you know, I think there is a change in the sense that because of the wave of struggles that you have, certainly in Britain, the hot 1830s, right, where some moments look like revolution, right? And because also of the struggles that you have late in the US and so forth, particularly after the 1870s, these were the highest moment, I think, in history probably of the socialist movement, right? The 1870, after the crisis, the big capitalist crisis of 1873, right, where you have, you know, in the United States, you even had a socialist Eugene Debs running for president. You had one of the most powerful socialist movements in Germany, right? So you have, under the impact of this development, you have a whole restructuring of social policies, right? And I think part of that restructuring was the policies, and you have to see them all together, allowing the union, legitimizing the union, so workers can organize, so the price of labor can be bargained and they can be contained. Right, in the States, the peak of that, of course, is in the 30s with the Wagner Act. Then you have Cavallo, right, the formation of the working class family, higher wages, women go back home from the factory, they are sent back home to actually create a better environment and reproduction for the workers. So the formation of the working class nuclear family, the union, and higher wages for men, where women, in fact, are made more wageless for that matter. But these three, and of course colonial expansion, which is the corollary, I mean, which is the greater canvas against which all these changes are happening. All of these developments, right, I think were very important in creating a new type of strategy where the working class was not reproduced any longer day by day, as you have, when you have peace rates, low wages, wages reduced to the minimum, the bayonet when workers go on strike, etc., etc. And you now instead have a strategy, right, where you know, basically increasingly, you know, wage increases and increases in productivity can be negotiated by the union, etc., etc. Right, and so you have a different type of strategy that certainly does not arise from you know, humanitarian impulse, but develops from a consideration of you know, power relations, and you know, periodically, I think it's very important to understand that periodically, yeah, capitalism, even though certain goals remain the same, certain fundamental strategies in terms of the accumulation of value, the accumulation of labor, profit, etc., remain the same, but how it is done continuously changes, and or at least goes through historic changes. You know, when the conditions, the fundamental condition for the social reproduction of you know, capitalist discipline have to be, you know, buttressed. Right? You know, there are moments of crisis, and then the whole system has to be reorganized so that everything, in a sense, remains the same, but on a new basis. I think that the term, the second part of the 19th century was one of those moments. I think the 80s and 90s have been one of those moments. I think the 60s and 70s were the moment of crisis. Right? It was a moment that shook up, you know, capitalist, if you want, accumulation process from its foundation. You know, you have the end of the anti-colonial movement, and many countries become independent, even if independence was very formal in some ways, but nevertheless, right, it produced a new generation of you know, youth, Africa, Latin America, etc., who had certain expectation from the world, had a certain expectation from that independence. And at the same time, you have a whole wave of movements, you know, in the areas of a so-called advanced capitalism, right? Student movement, factory movements, women's movement, right? So that in fact, what you have through the 60s and 70s, you really have an attack, you know, coming from different places on one of the most productive organizations of work, the capitalism itself, which has been the division of labor, which has been the division of the working class, which has been the creation of a whole set of different labor regimes, which have been instrumental to keeping workers divided, and corresponding to that also different type of bonding regimes, right, attached to these different work regimes. And, you know, what we call globalization, liberalization, and so forth are certainly, to me, a response to that, you know, another counter-revolution, if you want, and that began with the basics of capitalism. Capitalism has certain basic mechanisms. When you look at history, you can see how few the mechanisms that they have to launch themselves. Mass expropriation, this again, this time on the planetary level, with the structural adjustment, right? For example, one of the foundations of structural adjustment that was imposed in the name of the debt crisis through most of the so-called third world was land privatization. So, you know, you begin to have a process of massive land privatization as well as attack on wages, you know, state investment in local industry, production, liberalization of import, which destroyed the local industry, currency devaluation, which made people, etc., etc. You know, within a short time, you have a process, a creation of a new planetary landless proletariat. Landless and moneyless proletariat once again has to take the boats. And many of those boats have shipwrecked in the Mediterranean. And many have arrived to destination, have created a large immigrant population that now works in the European and US cities and so forth, right? That's fundamentally what globalization has been about. Globalization has been a restructuring of the fundamentals, right? The fundamental condition for the ability of a capitalist society to make profit, to accumulate labor, to impose a certain discipline of work. I think that part of that I was mentioning before, part of that restructuring has also been an international restructuring of reproductive labor, right? You know, there's been a lot written about sweatshops and how, you know, production is moving to sweatshop and so forth. Much less attention has been paid, although it's beginning to happen, I mean, but originally, to what globalization has meant from the point of view of the organization of reproductive work, right? The fact that, you know, the crisis that, for example, the women's movement has, initiated and brought about in the U.S., and Europe on the home front, right? The refusal of housework, the collapse of natality, which is still going on. That's a struggle, although it's not seen as a struggle. You know, more and more women, many women, refusing to have children, assuming under the conditions in which they're expected to have them, or refusing simply to identify as their life as mother. As a counterpart, you know, the reorganization of reproduction on an international basis, so that the other side of it has been, for example, the proliferation of surrogacy in countries of the third world, or baby farms, you know, where in many cases children are actually produced for export. It's not only that the children are abandoned and don't have a family, but they're actually children practically produced what is called the whole adoption market, right? The marketization of children. That's sort of been one aspect together with surrogacy of the re-international redefinition of reproductive work. There's been a similar redefinition of sexual work. So that, for example, if you look now, compare how sexual work was done in 20 years ago and presently in Europe and the US, you find a noticeable difference. For example, the organization of prostitution. I've done some work on it, particularly France, Italy, but I suspect the same is true in England as well, where while, you know, 30 years ago, you know, the street prostitute would have been an Italian woman or a woman, you know, a British woman and so forth. Now, it would be a woman from Africa or Eastern Europe, right? Because, again, as you know, sexual work has been reorganized, you know, to respond to some of the struggles that have taken place, for example, the prostitute movement struggle that at the end of the 70s was demanding new rights for prostitutes, etc., etc. Anyway, let me stop here and see if there are other questions. Yes.
Firstly, I just wanted to sort of mention in England at the moment, the government has put in place a number of attempts, I suppose, or organisations to tackle child poverty. And I just wanted to talk about the way this is being handled by the government and the way very often the mother and child are being separated at a very early stage of the infant. The infant's been placed in a nursery and the mother is being encouraged or forced by the withdrawal of benefits to go back to work. Mm-hmm. And how the government is actually sort of causing a massive sort of shift in the way society sees motherhood and the way mothers see themselves and how there is now so little space for mothers to be mothers or even to have the luxury of staying at home, and how that shift is affecting people's outlook. And I also wanted to sort of see, because I've done some work on the female body as a site of resistance, mm-hmm. mainly in terms of looking at self-harm and anorexia and gender relations. Right. You did mention it briefly in your talk about, you know, sort of women fainting and stuff, but I'm wondering how much women historically have used their bodies as a site of resistance. Mm-hmm. So the work I did came about through working in a probation hostel and noticing that a number of women who had come out of prison were actually self-harming quite catastrophically and being sectioned as a result of that self-harm. But that self-harm had started as an act of resistance to the powerlessness they had felt both as children, as abuse survivors, and as adult women in prison. And I just wondered how much, you know, evidence there is of that historically. I know the fainting is very much sort of like, you know, within the middle class women's domain, if you like. Working class women didn't have the option of fainting down the mines, so they were just being kicked aside. But how that sort of resistance and that internalisation of the power structures played out historically on the female body specifically.
Yeah, you know, I cannot, you know, give very quantitative measurements. I mean, I can only refer to the, you know, lots of material that feminist women's movement has produced. It basically has reclaimed all those invisible struggles, right? And particularly, while, for example, fragility, that has always been seen as, you know, part of a kind of female psychological makeup. And, you know, women have been seen it as, in fact, a refusal of sexual relations in which they had a subordinate role, in which they were forced into a sexuality that was alien to their needs and desires. And also mental illness, the breakdown. In fact, the here is the role of the medical profession as being paramount, because, for example, the whole development of lobotomy was, really targeted to women, and in particular to housewives. In fact, it was theorized, right, that since housewives didn't have to do, first of all, they really had a very high rate of breakdown, they stopped cooking, they stopped washing themselves, they started crying, they didn't want to go out of bed. Clearly, in any other circumstance, it would be called refusal of work. This would be a form of absenteeism if it was stays in the factory, but since it was in the home, it was not seen, right? So you had these doctors who theorized that lobotomy was really ideal for women, because since they didn't have, for example, great machineries to play with, they could actually be reduced to being a little dotty, and they would be okay, and you could lobotomize them, and actually they would make almost perfect wives. In fact, there's feminists have pointed out when they looked at the literature from the 19th century to and literature and culture that has described feminine roles from the 19th century to present, they have noticed that the ideal machine is always represented as a woman. That in the movie or in the, like for example, the Stepford Wives of 1975, where you have this man who turned their wives into robots. Has anybody heard about it?
Yeah.
Okay, right. That's and then there were other examples can be made. Right. So they saw the woman, the lobotomized woman, but they clearly saw and the interviews with nurses who work. In some work has been done and with verses that work in these wards, where women on an assembly line on some days in the 50s or 60s, when there was a protest against on an assembly line, they would be put into, some point lobotomy, but also electric shock, right, which produced similar results. They saw that these women who didn't want to wash, they were resisting. Right, they were refusing a certain role, and that's what. And by the way, in many cases, the witch was presented exactly as the other side, as the the rebellious wife. Right. In other words, in some of the treatises of on the witch hunt for the demonologists, the witch is the rebellious woman, the woman who is untamed, who doesn't want to be. It's like a counterpart, the negative image of the good, obedient wife. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned something about the anorexia, right? Anorexia is a very complex phenomenon because it's seen, and I don't know what to, because I think it's generally now interpreted certainly a product of resistance, right? Again, not a biological disease, but a disease that expresses an attempt by many young women to have control over their lives and also to fit not so much as an ideal of beauty, which is probably where the misconception about anorexia comes, that they are trying to make themselves beautiful, but trying to fit a certain conception of self-control, power to control one's needs, and capacity for being in control that they obviously see as valued in society. In other words, that the anorexic woman, it's a woman that both refuses a certain ideal of femininity and maternity and so forth, associated with the large bosom, the large hips, but also against a kind of nature woman, wants to project an image of a person who is in control, right? Not so much as fitting this particular type of beauty, but more as in a sense, and this is where I think is the negative part, I guess, being more like a man, right? There is a value in the society, clearly, that is placed, you know, from the 15th century to now, about being able to control yourself, being in charge of yourself, you know, being capable of self-government, restraining your needs, restraining your instinctual desires, and so forth. And in a sense, I find interesting the interpretation of anorexia that some feminists like to have given as a desire to fit into that mold. And by the way, that's an image also that most women, once they join the so-called workplace, particularly at the professional level, they have to fit it. Not necessarily being anorexic, but, you know, that if you want to have a certain position of credibility and prestige and presence, you know, you have, in a sense, to become like a man, right? And you know, the dressing, sometimes a little bow tie, there's a whole science, actually, there's a whole science that has been developed on how to look like a man without losing your femininity, because you don't want to be too much of a man, because then you're competing, you're invading, you're trespassing, and therefore you have to be like a man, you have to actually live out all those, you know, real kind of elements that are associated with femininity, and in fact you have to put your jacket and your attaché case, etc., etc., and masculinize yourself, you know, though continuously hinting that, no, I'm not, I don't want to be a man, I'm also possibly available for other things. So there is a continuity in there, perhaps, between the anorexic woman and also the woman, you know, with the, you know, in, with the image that she needs to project, you know, when she enters a traditional male world. I want to say something else, but I now have forgotten it. And maybe it will come back. It will come back later. I don't know. Oh, yes, I know what I wanted to say. It ties in with your first question, the question of maternity, which I think is also why many women now, I think we're now going for a second generation of women who had entered their world, you know, with their jackets and everything, and discovered that the schedule still of their world is not compatible. Is not compatible with the ability to have a family, to reproduce, to have children, to have a sociality, to have a social life, to have some sanity. That, you know, the famous double shift, but, you know, that this is now very, very difficult to carry on, and you do carry on at, often at the price of your own sanity, or at the price of, you know, basically conducting a monastic life, because the demands that are put upon you are not compatible with the demands of a family. So that you find now, I know this is true for the United States, that there's been a kind of diaspora of a number of women who join this type of position, teacher, colleges, or maybe some level of business, and then leave, because they still, that divide, that division of labor, you know, there's still two worlds, and you either are in one or in the other, or you bridge them at a fantastic cost for yourself, and also at a fantastic cost for your life, right?
Yes. Because I was trying to, and I didn't do it very well, but these schemes have been put in place in very poor areas, in areas that are socially deprived, where the options for a lot of young women are to passively seek some sort of status, or, that's really the wrong word, but through motherhood, mm-hmm. because there's very little in terms of sort of training opportunity. And the government has now decided that it's going to withdraw benefits from the and put in place childcare schemes specifically for, you know, specifically to take the child away from the mother, place it in daycare, and then encourage the mother to do training or retraining, go back to work.
Oh, okay, so like, you know, you and the are sort of talking about what is happening in terms of the whole organization of welfare.
And also this scheme being a, you know, sort of overall objective is supposed to decrease child poverty or address the issue of child poverty. But what it is in fact doing is forcing mothers into the workplace, often when they don't want to be there, and taking away any sort of like social recognition
motherhood
in these communities. And I just wanted to sort of share that information
what's happening
in my local area. And what's also happening is any child care is becoming totally centred around the working mother.
Mother.
There is no access, there's very few access to facilities for you. It's very isolating. And that idea of post-war, when they sent women back from the factories into the home to be produced, now undergoing some sort of transition forcefully. Well, I say forcefully, they're withdrawing benefits or they're, you know, the centuries limited or whatever. But now being sort of that transition is happening now in this country. Women are
now
placed back in the workforce.
Right. Well, we have been at the avant-garde of that. I have to say, this has been going on in the United States. It is mantling on the welfare system. Has been going on for many years now, you know, and there's a whole story about from welfare to workfare has been like the policy from, I would say, the beginning of the Nixon administration, but actually really being realized with Clinton and after. I want to say this, first of all, that the women's movement has a great responsibility for it. I was involved in the women's movement in the 70s, and the organization I was involved with, the women I worked with, we were basically campaigning to say that our slogan was that every woman is a welfare woman. You know, we are all one husband away from a welfare check, right? In the sense that the precariousness of women's access to resources, economic resources, you know, made every woman potentially a welfare woman. You know, you divorce, you were with a child, and the next day you were on a welfare line, even if they maybe a little before you had a little bit more comfortable life, right? And we said, in fact, you know, welfare is the first money that women have won for housework. It's the first recognition that actually housework, raising a child. In the United States, welfare was actually called aid to dependent children. Most of the women who own welfare were actually women in this program called aid to dependent children. And they said, this is the first recognition that housework is work. So we don't want welfare as a charity, right? We want the recognition that this work is work that we do for which the capitalist benefit, the society benefit, etc., etc. And instead, what we get in return is economic dependence, is poverty, etc., etc. So, but the women's movement, the strategy of the women's movement, in fact, you know, at the time we were campaigning for wages for housework to say this is work, and this is work that, in fact, you know, it's fundamental, it's pivotal to the accumulation of wealth in this society, because if women did not reproduce the working class or the workforce, there would be no workers to produce the cars and the commodities and whatnot. In any case, one of the obstacles we often find is that the mainstream strategy of the women's movement was to, you know, what they call joining the working class. The idea that, in fact, you know, women's power could be organized only in the wage workplace, and that, you know, the community was not a place of power, which was, of course, counterintuitive, but counter historical, because by the time the women's movement developed in the U.S., you know, in fact, the women's movement developed very much on the wake of the Black Power movement, you know, which had been a movement based fundamentally in the community. I mean, you know, there were struggles, particularly in Detroit, around the Revolutionary Union, but basically the Black Power movement, the civil rights movement was a movement based in the community. And in fact, part of the Black Power movement and civil rights movement was the struggle of welfare women, right? Not because most women on welfare in the United States were black women, but because they were the most organized. So in fact, there was a struggle that women on welfare had made, in which they were making exactly the point, you know. We are not doing charity work, I mean, we are producing children, that's what, you know. So, as I said, the slogan of the women's movement was join the working class. You know, there was a liberal who said join Wall Street, don't make the cake, market it. And the other said, you know, join the working class, raise, you know, workers' consciousness among women, leave the isolation of the home, etc., etc. Well, we saw what happened, that within a few years, not only starting with 75, 76, in fact, there was basically a collapse, I mean, a withdrawal of the women's movement. I mean, the women's movement had been a very powerful social force. And I don't want to say the women should not take brief jobs, please, by no means. But when that becomes your strategy for liberation, right, when that becomes your strategy for liberation, that becomes a problem. And one of the problems was that the struggle of women on welfare was practically abandoned. By the time the women's movement joined the struggle around welfare, it was very much too late. Practically so many cuts had been implemented that welfare didn't satisfy even the minimal needs, right? And, you know, in the 70s, because of the struggle of the women and men, at least in the States, they were all, you could live on a welfare check, not well, but certainly the welfare check was the beginning of a basis of a little independence for women. By the mid-80s, that had been lost, right? And what you're saying surprises me, not only because you're saying it's happening now, you know, we have gone a long way, but also because you're saying that the government now is organizing childcare to, you know, that's not happening in the States. In fact, they are telling women that they have to get off welfare and, you know, get jobs. But not only the jobs that they have open to them are kind of, you know, jobs that they pay almost nothing, but also there is no provision really for children. There's not really a free child care for the so-called working mother, right? And that too is also a problem with the women's movement, because I think the women's movement always placed the question of child care. They didn't say, look, women who are full-time housewives or do housework need to go to visit a friend. You know, they need to go to a movie, they need to go for a walk, they need to get a break. It was always for if you go out and get a job, right? Child care connected to, you know, the basically wage labor. So I think hopefully there's going to be some rethinking by the new generation of women. No, some rethinking about the question of reproduction, what they mean, because they have this question, the question of work, and the question of social relations, because so far they've been largely defined, you know, to fit needs, right, of the accumulation of wealth. And I think there is now I think this is beginning to happen. If we, particularly when you look on an international basis, I think on an international basis there's a lot of women's movement who are posing on the table the need to recreate certain commons, right? They need to reappropriate certain resources directly. They need to recreate form of collective reproduction. I at a conference in Latin America on women and globalization, I've heard the women of the a movement, the language movement of Brazil, right, who came and they described how they organized. And what they kept stressing over and over and over was that they would not have been able, for example, to reappropriate land, right, which is what they've been doing, you know, this movement to reappropriate land, if the women themselves had not reorganized everything, beginning with the organization of reproduction. And, you know, make sure that the people who come together to organize this takeover, land takeover, and the cultivation of the land that is being taken over, also work on a collective basis, organize reproduction on a collective basis, you know, where not only men take responsibility for reproduction, but also reproduction is done collectively, so that you know, you do have collective laundry, collective cooking, collective and that kind of solidarity, and solidarity is built, and where, you know, people are profoundly meshed into everybody's lives, so that, you know, as you used to say, an injury to one is an injury to all, where you actually share your life, not only for the space of a demonstration, you know, or going to the street for a few hours, or the space of a meeting, but you actually begin to share your life in you know, to put everything in common, so to speak. And I think we have to do that too. Otherwise, we have very, very, we already have hard time in front of us, but we can have even harder time than now.
I really need a drink, so if everybody's happy, we could
fold it up,
have a drink, and then have a chat with Sylvia at the bar.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.